Good morning. The House Judiciary Civil Subcommittee is now in session. Welcome to the session this morning. I'll call your attention just to a couple of things so we can understand both the ground rules and our tentative time requirements. You should have a schedule. A schedule should be available indicating what bills will be heard at what times. We did really well yesterday in getting out on time, and the committee is appreciative of that. We hope we can maintain that this morning. The first two bills will be House Bill. The first block is House Bills 2744 and 3208, and I will open a
3212.
And House Bill 3212, that's correct. I will open a public hearing on each of those bills at this time, and I'll ask counsel first to explain the bills.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2744 provides that a plaintiff in a civil action must pay prevailing party fees to a defendant who makes an offer of compromise if the plaintiff fails to obtain a more favorable judgment than what the defendant offered in the offer of compromise, and it requires that a court order a settlement conference upon the request of either party. Currently, if a plaintiff doesn't obtain a more favorable judgment than the defendant offers in an offer of compromise, the plaintiff is required to pay the costs from that time, and so this adds prevailing party fees to that cost as well. House Bill 3208 covers pleading requirements that we discussed yesterday in House Bill 2745. We will not be discussing those today. The two parts of this bill that we will be discussing are regarding our House Bill. It mandates a settlement conference in an action in which a professional liability claim is made, and allows a defendant in a professional liability claim to request the impaneling of a common sense jury if a claim is more than $50,000. And it requires an award of a reasonable attorney fee to defendant if a common sense jury determines that the claim is meritless and the plaintiff does not receive any money award at trial. And finally, House Bill 3212 authorizes the use of binding arbitration in lieu of civil actions for injuries and damages suffered as a result of receiving services from a licensed professional. It provides that a claim is subject to binding arbitration if a client and a licensed professional enter into agreement to arbitrate. It also provides that an arbitration is the exclusive remedy if a claim is subject to binding arbitration, and prescribes procedures for the contents of agreements to arbitrate, and establishes time limitations and processes for claims subject to binding arbitration.
Thank you. We'll have the same format as we did yesterday. I'll call a representative of the proponents of the bills, Kevin Mannix, to come forward, the representative of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, Richard Lane, to come forward. We each have a 5-minute piece for an overview, and then we'll get into the public hearing on these three bills. Keeping in mind our target for this block of bills is 10 o'clock this morning. If it's necessary to go over, that's okay. We probably will have some flexibility in the afternoon if that's necessary. Gentlemen, start your engines.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Kevin Mannix. I'm a Salem attorney, and I'm the project manager for the Oregon Litigation Fairness Project. As to the three bills which are being heard in the current time block, I would mention that yesterday we filed with the committee, and we brought in copies for the public again today, a packet of information under the Oregon Litigation Fairness Project heading, which contains talking points on all the bills being discussed yesterday and today, and we would ask that that packet be considered part of the record for each bill being considered by the Legislative Assembly, this civil subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee. As to House Bill 2744, the bill basically is designed to give further encouragement to the early settlement of claims. Counsel has already described the bill, and the bill is a halfway step, as it reads right now, towards leveling the playing field to encourage settlement offers by saying that if the plaintiff doesn't accept a given settlement offer and then later recovers less, that the plaintiff not only in the future would have to pay costs, but also prevailing party fees. We've suggested that there be an additional push in that you also include attorney fees in this bill, the idea being that you truly would have a level playing field when it comes to somebody coming in with an offer. Please understand right now that if it cuts completely against the defendant right now in the settlement situation, but it does not cut completely against the plaintiff, and we would assert that that playing field ought to be leveled. As to House Bill 3208, we won't discuss the element of House Bill 2745, which is in here, which was discussed yesterday. There are two other elements to this bill which were described by counsel. One is the requirement of a mandatory settlement conference in a case relating to professional performance of services or services by a licensed professional. The time has come to impose greater pressure on the parties to come to the table in these kinds of cases. All it requires is that the parties come to the table. Right now, attorneys are certainly bound by the wishes of their clients, and they often will have a client who is recalcitrant about the settlement process. This absolves attorneys of the problem of worrying about whether or not the client wants to come to the table. It says there will be a settlement conference. It's very straightforward about that. And frankly, when you have somebody running a settlement conference, even if you have someone who was unwillingly brought into the room, there will be a change in the environment of the case through the exchange of information, through the exchange of positions, and we would hope an increased rate of settlement of these cases. The second element is a discretionary item with the defense, and it involves a case against a licensed professional where the value in question is over $50,000, and it brings up the novel idea of saying that the defendant in such a case can say, we would like to have a common sense jury panel. Now, this bill really could be modified in several ways, one of which is to say that either side should be able to insist that that process be used. It also can be modified to take the time limitation out in terms of the jury panel's decision-making process. But the idea of having the parties come in front of a jury for, in effect, a preliminary review is a great idea. First of all, you will have real people sitting to hear the basic positions of the parties. The parties can outline those positions to those real people. Those real people can decide whether or not the plaintiff's position has merit or not. If they say the plaintiff's position has merit, that puts a lot of pressure on the defense to come to the table with a settlement offer, or to give up, for that matter. On the other hand, if they say the case is meritless, the one thing that it imposes on the plaintiff is you want to go forward after that, it's loser pays. You're in a new ball game. You weren't able to convince a majority of six real people that there was merit to your case, given the opportunity to argue your case. Now you can proceed, but now the price of admission is the danger that if you lose this case, you're going to have to pay for, in effect, the cost of the defense. This approach is a modification of loser pays. It allows everyone a chance at a jury for making their basic arguments about a case. It doesn't prevent anybody from getting to a jury ultimately if they want to, but it also brings a breath of common sense fresh air into the litigation process. Time being short, I'll move forward quickly to House Bill 3212. This bill, again, is an attempt to expedite the litigation process by turning more towards support for binding arbitration where it's been agreed upon. And it's limited to, again, licensed professionals that have a valid arbitration agreement. And there are requirements in this legislation as to what is necessary in the process to make that a valid arbitration agreement. Those requirements are good protections so that someone isn't into, in effect, a contract of adhesion. You're making a choice about services of a professional. In making that choice, the professional can also say, if you want me to serve you, I want to be able to insist that if we have any differences, it will go into binding arbitration. And we'd encourage the consideration of that bill. Thank you very much.
Fine. Thank you very much. You're right on at 5 minutes. Mr. Lane?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Richard Lane. I am here today on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and I'm here to encourage your opposition to House Bill 2744, 3208, and 3212. And I will endeavor to get through all three bills inside of the 5 minutes allocated. Starting with 2744, you'll note that's a change to the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, Rule 54. historically, I would say, any type of amendment to the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure has passed through Council on Court Procedures, which is a body made up of an equal number of plaintiff's attorneys, an equal number of defense attorneys, and an equal number of judges. There's a public input and a public process associated with that, and posting and the comment period of time before a rule is amended and then submitted to the legislature for their review. That process works very well for airing these procedural changes that are somewhat arcane, and also strikes a balance between all of the parties concerned in litigation, the judiciary, and both sides. This bill has not gone through the council. I would recommend that if it is worthy of being considered, it should start at the council and then be returned to you if that's where it goes. The bill as itself does not level the playing field. Yesterday we spoke a little bit about alleged increase in frivolous suits. This has nothing to do with frivolous suits. This has to do with meritorious claims, because it concerns the section where one or the other party makes an offer to compromise a claim out. And if you choose, under existing law, if you choose not to accept that offer, then you cannot recover your costs if you prevail in the action. This would change that. If you make the offer and it is not accepted and you don't do better than the offer, then you would be subject to the opposing side's prevailing party fees, which under existing law can be up to $5,000. So in essence, it provides a hammer to a businessman in a small business dispute or a consumer, where if the claim in dispute is $1,500 or $10,000, whatever number you want to pick, and a low-ball offer is made on that, say $1,200 on a $1,500 claim, say $9,000 on a $10,000 claim. The risk of not getting your full 10, but recovering the 9 or the 12 on the count, means you could be subjected to $5,000 worth of prevailing party fees. And that's why this rule has never included prevailing party fees. It allows the recovery of costs as one element of not accepting the tender, but it does not get into the punitive nature. It does not provide any sort of sanction for going forward with a meritorious claim, one that is everybody recognizes is a legitimate claim, because there's money being tendered back and forth. So that's the reason why we oppose 2744. 2744 also has a mandatory settlement conference, and I'll talk to the two bills that have this element inside of it. Parties are free to negotiate, involve themselves in alternative dispute resolution of many types, a judge, a neutral third party, informal discussions between the parties, which often takes place. So parties that are willing to resolve their cases do not need mandatory direction to go see a sitting judge, which is also going to eliminate the possibility of using some third-party neutral mediator or one of the other retired judges or many of the services that are out there for alternative dispute resolution. This selects sitting judges in, I'm assuming, the circuit court where the action is brought. So you're taking judicial resources away from being able to prosecute other criminal cases, because they would have to be involved in these settlement conferences. You're eliminating alternative third-party services that are also available. And it mandates it when the parties may just not be in a position to settle a case, so you're wasting everybody's time and the money associated with that. 3208, we're not going to talk about the certificate. We talked about that in 2745 yesterday. Turning to the mandated settlement conference section, again, it has problems with the mandated, but more importantly with Section 2, House Bill 3208, it talks about the professionals, and again, like yesterday, we're talking about across the board, it's any registered or certified trade profession connected with the state, so you're across the board, you're not in any one area of a professional. But in 2003, through the efforts of then-Senator John Minnis and working with the OMA and the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, what became ORS 31.250 was passed in the 2003 session. And that requires mandatory alternative dispute resolution in any action against a healthcare practitioner or a healthcare facility within 270 days of the action being filed. So in that narrow area, we already have existing law that mandates a settlement conference within 270 days of filing. So again, you're too broad in sucking all of the possible professions in. You're also mandating it may not be something that the parties are interested in doing. The common sense jury, I have a tough time with that term because I'm wondering the cases that I try that have 12 Oregonians selected from the community, I think have common sense. And that's the system we have now and we've had for 200 years. Individuals selected from the community to resolve cases that bring to the table their common sense in considering all the evidence. I think that this is a burden placed on parties to present their cases twice. It's a burden in the expense and costs associated with that. It now has a punitive sanction against if six people, let me take a step back, you're only entitled to 2 hours to present your entire case. And that in itself, you may not be able to present the evidence on any type of business dispute, malpractice case, or what have you, inside of 2 hours. And then I understand Mr. Minnis is talking about amending it, but the jury is only allowed 2 hours to deliberate on that particular case. So no matter the complexity of the issues or the number of witnesses that were presented or the difficulty of the subject matter, 2 hours and they're out. That is not a way to resolve cases, and I don't think that any particular finding through that process should be imposing a punitive loser pay aspect if that party decides to move forward and allow themselves to take advantage of the constitutional protections to a right to a jury trial and have 12 people with common sense consider that case. Quickly to 3212, in the state of Oregon now, any party at any time can request that a particular dispute be resolved by binding arbitration. It's a mechanism that is employed often, particularly in business suits, but it's also been involved in particular injury-type actions. So it already exists under law. What this bill does is allows professionals to, what I'll use as a word, is make a contract of adhesion that you, to get my services, are going to have to give up your constitutional right to a jury trial. You're saying in advance of a particular injury or a particular harm that anybody suffers, you're signing away your constitutional rights just to get the service. Now, if you're putting on a wing on your house, perhaps you have the opportunity to consult with a number of contractors. You find out what the lay of the land is. You talk to a number of people. Maybe you negotiate. Maybe you have equal bargaining powers. That is not the case when you talk about all professionals that this would apply to. There are going to be situations where either because of a lack of competition or a geographic area that it is going to be a take it or leave it. If you want me to do something, you've got to give up your constitutional rights. And that's wrong. It's not something that this committee should pass forward. The other part of 3212, just briefly, is a section that concerns time limits. And right now in Oregon, you have 2 years from the date of discovery to file an action against a wrongdoer to pursue a claim. 3212 requires that a claim be presented within 6 months of discovery, and in no case may a case be pursued more than 1 year after the date of service. So whether you know you've been harmed, or whether you don't know you've been harmed, or who did any of the harm associated with it, you're barred from accessing either the arbitration or the courts. Again, that's pretty punitive, and it's a vast change of existing law right now. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. I'm sorry for the race there on the 5 minutes.
That's okay. I'll give you even more time if you think you need it. So you just have to let us know as we proceed through all of the witnesses. Each want to come back and do some little bit of rebuttal, that's fine, too. We'll keep it open for that.
Thank you.
Let's hang on for questions now. Yes, Representative Garrard.
Mr. Chair, this is for Mr. Mannix. I have a letter here from Cameron Wogan, who is the presiding judge in the 13th Judicial District, who is very much opposed to this bill because he says, quote, it would remove the court's authority to order a settlement conference on its own motion. And he further explains, I do not like House Bill 2744 because it would remove the court's discretion to manage each case. sometimes a party may ask for a settlement conference for the wrong reasons, and he would like to retain the option to decline a request.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrard, first of all, I think that it'd be easy enough to leave it in that it can be done on the court's own motion, even if not. I have no problem with leaving in the current language about the court's own motion. About the judge's power to run the case, and this ties in the comments on the Council on Court Procedures, to be blunt about it, the legal system often is run by the lawyers, for the lawyers, of the lawyers. The entire judicial branch of government consists of people who have to pass the bar exam, have to have a degree from an accredited law school. The judiciary is composed entirely of lawyers. The lawyers then are ruled by the Oregon State Bar. The Oregon Supreme Court is the ultimate authority over that entire branch of government. Within that entire context, we lawyers tend to get the attitude that we ought to be in charge of everything. And this bill speaks to the right, all these bills actually speak to the right of the people to make policy decisions about what's right for the litigation process without always being told by the lawyers and judges. I respect the Council on Court Procedures. I think that they often have great ideas. But again, it's by the lawyers, of the lawyers, for the lawyers, through the judicial process. As to the question as to whether or not the court should be able to refuse a party saying, I want a settlement conference, I respectfully disagree with the judge. I think that any party to a case ought to be able to say, I want a settlement conference. I think the other side is being recalcitrant. I do agree with the point the judge made that the judge ought to be able to order it on the judge's own motion, and the bill should be changed to take that away.
Thank you.
Rather, to put it back in.
Ms. Lane?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrard, and I would just note probably for the rest of the committee's benefit that existing ORCP 54 Section F, which is on line 26 of the bill, presently states that a settlement conference may be ordered by the court, and that's existing law, and that's usually the case.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. This is from Mr. Lane. You talked about a common sense jury. If you want one of those, just go to trial. And would it be fair to say that it can often cost tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars to even get to that point? And wouldn't you want to, what would you have against trying to avert having to go that far? Why wouldn't you want to at least have an upfront opportunity to establish the merit of a claim?
Representative Thatcher, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my objection to the bill and the common sense jury and substituting what I believe is already the exercise of common sense by juries and panel to hear cases is the restrictions on the presentation of evidence, the time limitations on it, the punitive nature associated with going forward and exercising your constitutional right, and the fact that you're going to be subjected to significant fees and costs for exercising that right. As far as the process is concerned, the cost associated with pursuing any case presently depends very much on the nature of the facts in dispute. Obviously, the cost associated with a complex medical malpractice type of case are going to be greater than perhaps a small contract business dispute where you can just bring in the two parties, explain what the nature of the contract was. Some products cases, medical cases, I understand patent cases now, require a great deal of expert testimony, and that's one of the greatest costs that both parties are subjected to in pursuing the presentation of the evidence, given the complex nature of the case.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee?
May I respond to that question, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Thatcher, I think that some of the criticisms of the bill in terms of the content are appropriate. For instance, the language of the bill needs to be changed to allow each side to present an outline of their case to a common sense jury. There's no way that you can present evidence and testimony. It should be an outline of the case, similar to what you might do in an opening statement to a jury. That's one modification that's necessary. Another modification that would be appropriate is to take away the time limitation for the jury's deliberations. So this bill is a work in process, a diamond in the rough. I hope it's a diamond in the rough, if you will. But the idea of testing your case preliminarily with a jury panel is an idea that I think is worth proceeding with, and it's in this case it's presented in a limited context to allow us to experiment with it to see if it helps the adjudication process. Thank you.
Okay, I'll continue the debate, Mr. Lane.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. I wanted to just make sure Representative Thatcher and the other members of the committee that may not be familiar with case presentation, opening statements are not evidence. And that's probably the problem, and I think counsel agrees with me. The jury that presently decides cases decides it on evidence, and that's why when I spoke about how they'd reach a decision, it was based upon evidence, because oral argument of myself or anybody representing a party is not evidence.
Can I clarify that too, Mr. Chairman?
Okay.
That was my whole point, was to back away from the idea of presenting evidence. Present your contentions. Present your theory of the case and see whether or not these folks think it's worth something. If they think it's worth something, fine. You get to proceed it with no burden. If they don't think it's worth something, then you know that you can proceed with the burden of having to pay the defense costs for the other side. Thank you.
Let me ask then a follow-up question on the so-called common sense jury. If I can make this presentation, assuming I'm the plaintiff's lawyer, on representations or opening statements and no quote, evidence, unquote, suppose I have a meritless case, but it's supported by junk science, and I make that representation to the jury. You don't object. You can't object because we're just making representations. And don't you think that's a flaw in the process and would let the plaintiff to convince a jury that his case had merit when, if you employed the rules of evidence, he may not?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that here I am, having criticized the bar generally and conceptually a couple of minutes ago, I come back to, we do have ethical standards for attorneys, and the representations that they make, first of all, in front of the jury as to what they expect to present in their case need to be reasonably tied to some basis. And at some point, I think another attorney might challenge them if they make statements as to what the case is going to develop or what they hope the case will develop when there's no reasonable basis for that. It's a system that would have to be tested out and to see what the nuances are, what the process is all about. And so I don't have an answer as to if someone comes up with the junk science, which we were criticizing yesterday. When you get to the point of having to present your evidence, remember that if you started talking junk science in your opening statement or your presentation to the common sense jury and you got past the common sense jury, you still have to go to trial. So we're no worse off than we are right now. On the other hand, if you end up not convincing even a common sense jury, then we've eliminated probably another piece of litigation that shouldn't go forward.
Okay. Any other questions, counsel?
It's for Mr. Mannix. If a case went before a common sense jury and they found that it had merit, would you be willing to say that the rules of pay system would go into effect, essentially saying that the defendants would have to pay, or that the plaintiffs would have to pay the cost of the defendants? Sorry, if the defendants would have to pay the cost of the plaintiffs if the case did have merit and they went on and then got a jury settlement.
I mean, Chairman Counsel, I think that that too is a fair concept to introduce to this, that if the jury, common sense jury, says it has merit and you proceed, in many cases you end up, I'd want to take a look at the contingent fee agreements or whatever else there are, but I don't mind a provision that says it cuts both ways, and if they say it has merit and you insist on continuing to defend the case and you don't settle it, that there's some imposition placed on the defense for that.
Further questions from the committee? Thank you, gentlemen. I'll call up the next set of witnesses. On these three bills, I have people, of course, signed up on two and sometimes all three. So as I call your names to come up, you can indicate which particular bills you have an interest in, and we'll just proceed that way because we have an open public hearing on all three bills open at this time. Trying to see how many other people we have here that are in favor of any of the bills. I don't see anybody else in favor of you.
I haven't seen anything.
Okay, then I'll call Teresa Booth and Jason Reynolds, and I'll leave it there. We'll take these two first.
Hi, my name is Teresa Booth, and my son Michael Bridwell was born 2 months premature because the doctor failed to read the ultrasound. And with any kind of arbitration or CAPS.
Did you give us your name? I may have missed it.
My name is Teresa Booth.
Okay. Go ahead. Thank you.
And with any kind of CAPS or arbitration on malpractice or anything like that, I wouldn't be able to afford to take care of him because he has he has medical needs. And our feelings are the doctor did this to Michael. Why should Michael have to pay to suffer and not be able to afford the things that he deserves?
Does that conclude your testimony?
I don't know if Michael wants to say anything or if he could say anything. Do you want to say anything? Can you?
You can come forward if you wish.
He's had over 35 medical procedures now, and he has a few more to go before he's 21.
And how old is he now?
He's 12. His okay. First one was the day after he turned a year.
Okay, if you could just state his name or you can introduce him, either way.
This is my son, Michael Bridwell.
Yeah, Michael?
Well, as she said, I was born 2 months premature. And as she said again, how should I pay for the doctor's mistakes? How should I suffer my life not doing what I want to do? So I think three, whatever this bill is called, is wrong. The bill 3212 is just plain wrong. Because eliminating our rights for a jury is wrong. Eliminating our rights to a jury is wrong. And if we do that, how could we expect for people?
Go forward.
Go forward and tell their story.
Thank you for your story. Do you want to conclude for your son and yourself? And then we'll hold open for questions in just a couple of minutes. So leave your son here.
Michael's in sixth grade. He has to have an aide with him at all times because you notice he walks with a walker. He cannot carry his books like regular kids. He gets tired a lot easier. He's got multiple. Within this year, he's had pneumonia 3 times, and he was diagnosed at a year old with cerebral palsy. When he was born, he weighed 4 pounds 3 ounces, so he was just a little guy. And he was in the hospital a month after when I took the doctor to court. The judge told the doctor to settle an hour before we were supposed to go to trial. The doctor has not been brought up for discipline in the medical field. He's still practicing. He still gets paid every day. Michael, on the other hand, won't be able to go into the military, which what he would really love to do because of his physical disability. The doctor pretty much took away his full of life with making people not go through trial or the doctor not paying for what the doctor did. Mm-hmm. Michael suffers, or the people suffer. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we'll hold it open for questions in just a minute and hear from the last witness on this panel.
Jason Reynolds, Executive Director of the Oregon Consumer League. Mr. Chair and members, thanks for the opportunity to testify today. I'm not an attorney, so I've done my best with these bills, but I fear any more barriers being put in front of consumers before they have their day in court, starting with, for example, 3212, binding arbitration. Arbitration is secret. There's no appeal. The arbiter doesn't have to pay attention to the rule of law. It's corporations that do repeat business, the hospitals, the doctors, etc., not the consumer who's hopefully injured just once. And it's often more expensive than court in studies. It's very difficult to get reviews of what the results are because no one's keeping those statistics and making them available. But there was just one, recently, people got to examine USA First, the credit cards complaints, and there were 15,000 complaints last year. Of those 15,000 decisions, 87 were in favor of the consumer. So 99.9% of the cases go for the corporation or the person with the deep pockets. For all those reasons, we think that binding arbitration is a raw deal for consumers. Mediation, fine. Binding arbitration, it's got all these problems. We would like to see any system keep records so that the attorney general, the bar, or someone could say, you know what, if 9 out of 10 times it goes for the business, something may be wrong here. Not necessarily, but maybe. In user pays, many people wouldn't be able to pursue a case against a doctor. Can you imagine a copyright infringement case against Microsoft if you're a small company and you end up having they offer you something low and you can't get more than that because of whatever reason in court, and you end up owing their legal bill? That's going to be an impediment to small businesses, to consumers, even if the settlement is small. $5,000 and I've got $25,000 worth of damages. I can't take the chance that I won't get an award, because if I don't get what was offered me for whatever reason, I'm on the hook for hundreds of thousands of dollars and I lose everything. That's not an acceptable level of risk. And finally, on 3208, it creates two hurdles before you get to court. I was very badly injured in a car accident. I was at a red light. Someone smashed into me, doing over 40. He wasn't paying attention. And the vertebrae in my neck are crushed. And I went to an insurance company doctor because that was part of the procedure. And the doctor said, there's really wrong motion, range of motion, there's obviously damage, etc. When he wrote the insurance report, however, he said that I was making it up, and the insurance company accused me of fraud. Now, my x-ray shows that, as my rheumatologist said, my first vertebrae is okay, but the rest of them aren't, and the bottom four are crushed, leading to astonishing amounts of pain. I was at that time not the executive director of the Oregon Consumer League. I was head of the creative factory, which did public relations for lawyers and mostly surgeons, from the Heart Institute at St. Vincent Hospital to the Portland Orthopedic Clinic. We were the top shop for doctors who wanted to make a name for themselves. I couldn't get a doctor to agree to even look critically at what another doctor did. It was a closed, old boy system. To get a doctor, it doesn't happen. I mean, it may happen, but it's a burden that I don't think should be on the shoulders of someone that's injured and can't sleep and is in pain and has no money because of the disability, which was the state I was in. I'll take questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee to the panel? Seeing none, then we'll excuse you and thank you again for your testimony this morning.
Thank you, Mr.
I'll call up next Daryl Fuller. I know you are probably a proponent of these bills, so I should have called you earlier. You didn't indicate your preference on the witness sheet, so I misread it.
Chair, members of the committee, For the record, my name is Darrell Fuller. I'm here today in my capacity as the lobbyist for the Oregon Auto Dealers Association and also as president of the Oregon Small Business Coalition. And my testimony is on House Bill 2744 only. And I am here in support of the bill. The Auto Dealers Association introduced a bill two or three sessions ago, or at least entertained the thought of having one introduced. I can't remember if we did or not. That would have narrowly tailored this particular bill to the auto industry only, because it had a great interest to us. If you have a customer who is unhappy and that customer comes back to the dealership, we're going to do what we can to try to solve that customer's problem. Customer service is important to any business that wants to survive. Sometimes customers don't come back to the business when they have a complaint. They go elsewhere and complain to somebody else. If they complain to the Better Business Bureau, we have an opportunity to resolve the dispute. Sometimes they'll complain to the Department of Justice, and when that happens, we'll get a notice from the Department of Justice that a complaint has been filed against one of our dealers, and the dealer has the opportunity to voluntarily resolve the dispute. If a consumer, on the other hand, starts out by going to an attorney, the attorney often will start out with a demand letter. And that demand letter will say, in order to make this problem go away, this is what it'll cost you. And I will take exception to one remark that Mr. Lane said in regards to House Bill 2744, which is that you're dealing only with meritorious claims because the defendant is offering money to make the problem go away. That doesn't necessarily mean the claim has merit. If you take anything away from my testimony over the last 2 days, I hope that you will understand that businesses routinely settle out of court to make a potential case go away, not because it has merit, but because it is cheaper to settle than it is to prove you're right. The cost of going through litigation and winning and prevailing in court is often more expensive than just paying the demand letter. So there are numerous cases where something has no merit at all, but a settlement offer will be made by the defendant before a case is even filed. If we get a demand letter, one of the dealers I represent gets a demand letter from an attorney, we will often try to, and it's a term of art in our industry, unwind the deal. They're unhappy with their purchase. We will take the vehicle back. We will give them their trade-in back or the amount of money we offered them on their trade-in. We will set them back exactly where they were before they started, in addition to paying their attorney's fees for writing the demand letter. We will just unwind the deal completely. Unfortunately, a lot of attorneys do not encourage their clients to take those kind of settlements offers. They prefer to shoot for the moon. We can get more if we continue to go. This was just their first response. They're trying to get away with spending as little as possible, which I admit is true. We're willing to unwind the deal. But either the client or the attorney will see the potential for getting more money, and they'll want to continue on in the process. I'll give you an example. A demand letter asks for $5,000. Let's say the defendant offers to settle for $4,000, and they go to trial, and the jury awards them $3,000. So we offered them $4,000. They only got three. So they got $1,000 less than what we were offering. But the cost to the business in litigating the case can be $3,000 or $4,000. So you add the $3,000 or $5,000 it costs us to litigate the case, in addition to the $3,000 that we play out to the plaintiff, we're now into the case $8,000, $9,000, or $10,000. The plaintiff actually lost. We won on the merits because they got less than they asked for. But our victory costs us two or three times what we'd offered in a settlement. Where if the plaintiff had accepted the $4,000, they would have got $1,000 more than they got at trial. So they lose, but we also lose because it costs us so much more to prove that we were right or to get a judgment that is less than what we offered initially. I think what this does is it causes the plaintiff's counsel to sit back and think real carefully when they get a reasonable settlement offer on whether or not they want to put their client at risk of getting less money and having to pay costs when they have a reasonable offer on the table. Does it make more sense for them at that point to accept an offer that makes the defendant whole, takes care of their problem, covers their attorney's fees, okay, and keeps the case out of the court system, or do they potentially lose on behalf of their client even though they prevail and receive some money judgment? In the case that I, the example that I gave you, the business, again, that prevails on the fundamentals and gets a lesser award than they were even willing to offer, still loses in the pocketbook. And it seems to me that that is a fundamentally unfair system that allows that to happen. And I think what this does is it moves the pendulum back just a little bit the other direction and puts a little bit more emphasis on the plaintiff's bar looking at settlement offers and perhaps encouraging their clients to take advantage of some of the offers that they're made. And with that, I'll be glad to answer any questions that you have.
Brian, thank you for your testimony, Mr. Fuller. Do we have questions from the committee? Seeing none,
thank you.
You're excused then. Thank you very much. I'll call up the third and last panel, Bruce Miller, Brad Swank, and Brian Johnston. Gentlemen, please come forward. Proceed any manner you wish.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm here to talk to you for a moment. By the way, I'm from the State Court Administrator's Office, representing the state courts here. On House Bill 2744, we're not taking a position, but I wanted to point out a couple of impacts that would result from this bill. On page 1, lines 26 and 27, there are two changes made to how settlement conferences are run. The first change is that settlement conferences are now mandatory when requested by a party, rather, and that takes the discretion away from the judge as to whether a settlement conference is appropriate in that situation. And then the second change is that a court can no longer order a settlement conference on its own motion, which again takes away the court's discretion on how to manage these cases and how to move them towards settlement. The practical impact of this is that it actually removes tools from the court's toolbox on how to handle cases. For instance, in Multnomah County, there's a local rule that requires all cases go through some form of ADR, alternative dispute resolution, or settlement conference. Under this change, they would be required to do settlement conference, removing the other tools, and also removing the tool of the judge being able to decide if a settlement conference is actually going to be appropriate for the particular case in front of him. We just wanted you to be sure to understand what the impacts were of this change. Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Brad Swank. I'm Special Counsel for Government Relations for the Oregon Judicial Department. I'm here to speak briefly on 3208. We haven't taken a position on 3208, but I thought I would raise some questions in your mind seeking some clarity from the legislature and what it was intending, if it intends to proceed with this, particularly in relation to what to Section 3 is called the common sense juror. And I'm jury, and I'm aware of how juries operate, and I'm aware of how focus groups operate, and I'm trying to discover whether this is more like a regular jury or more like a focus group, because there are a lot of questions that aren't answered in the bill about how this would work. First of all, you heard Mr. Mannix earlier talking about whether it was a good idea to have evidence or not to have evidence, and the bill is permissive. It said people may present evidence. It calls the proceedings informal, and it says it's not binding. Let me raise some issues that you might want to consider when you consider this about how you want it to work. Some of these issues could affect the costs of this proceeding, and some of them just affect how it works and how it affects the parties. First of all, if you have evidence, are you going to have somebody ruling on evidence, making a decision about whether or not it would be evidence that would also be admissible in trial? Because, as you know, sometimes there are certain kinds of evidence that parties would like to present, but in trial they're not admissible. They may be hearsay. They may be founded, as Mr. Mannix said, on junk science or some other thing. And in a normal trial, a party would object, saying, "I object to the entrance of that." entry of that evidence and the judge would rule? Are you going to have rulings on evidence in this common sense jury? Are you even going to have a judge? The bill is silent about whether or not a judge would be present. In a focus group, you wouldn't need a judge present, but in a jury, you'd almost always have a judge present to control what goes in. And if you don't have a judge, do you have somebody else to sort of manage what's going on? Are you creating a record? Now, the bill says informal, but it doesn't speak to a record. Now, to some extent, you're going to need a record from a common sense jury because you're going to hold something against one of the parties at the end of the trial based upon what the common sense jury decides. So you're going to need some kind of record. What kind of record would you like? What's the standard of proof? The bill says that the common sense jury decides on meritless claims. What is the standard of proof for a meritless claim? And there are different standards of proof in cases. For instance, a police officer needs a probable cause standard in order to write up a ticket for somebody on the street for a traffic infraction or violation. In many civil cases, you need a more likely than not case standard of proof to make certain decisions. What is the level of proof on what determines a meritless case? What does the jury have to decide on? And who instructs the jury? Again, if you don't have a judge, the person who would normally instruct a jury, then you have to have somebody. And what about questions of applicable law? Many times there are differences about what the law means in a case, and a case can vary substantially based upon whether you may not be even using Oregon law. You could be using Washington law in some instances. And who decides that in terms of the common sense jury? Do you want it open to the public? Currently, any jury proceeding is going to be open to the public, although the deliberations of the jury would not. That's a question because somebody's going to be presenting a case that they have to present later. Do you want that to be on the evening news? Are there preclusion of issues? One of the interesting things is if you have the common sense jury to begin with and they present a case and it's more like a focus group than a real jury, then do they have to argue the same case when they get to trial? Or if they discover that they presented a really bad case and they reorganize it before trial, could they present a completely different case, different witnesses, different evidence? Or is there some kind of preclusion of issues? And if they argue a different case when you get to trial, does the defendant say, but wait, the jury found, the common sense jury found that their case was meritless, now they've presented a different case. Am I to lose my attorney fees because of that? Anyway, what if they make a mistake? What if they make a mistake about presenting the law at the common sense jury? They decide in a choice of laws issue that it's Washington's law rather than Oregon's law that's applied. But when you get to the case, the judge rules that it's Oregon's law that applies. So they made a mistake at the common sense jury, is that something that you can raise at the end of the trial to change who gets attorney fees? These are questions. How much supervision does the court need to provide? What sort of proceeding do you envision that if you don't resolve in the bill, they will be litigated, and they'll be litigated at the expense of the parties because somebody will claim that whatever the court did, it was wrong and it should have structured the common sense jury differently. And all we're looking for is if you decide to go with a common sense jury, please resolve some of these issues so we're not litigating what we should have done for years to decide how the common sense jury should operate. Do you want it more like a real jury? Done it more like a focus group? And at what point in between there do you want some formality in the proceedings and some control? I can answer any questions at the end if you'd like. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Johnston. I had the pleasure of speaking in front of you yesterday. I first taught a dispute resolution course in 1984. I've taught one every year since then. And directed the program at Willamette University College of Law and have been a fellow at Pepperdine School of Law since 1989 in the same field. I came out of self-imposed exile from the legislature to talk yesterday on some of these bills, and I'm here today to talk on 3208. And the 3208, my first comment is, I sure wish we could stop referring to it as common sense juries. I find that offensive to the other jury. What is the other jury then? The jury that lacks common sense? It's kind of harmful, I think. The topic and the concept itself comes from a pilot program that was instituted first in the Federal District Court in Ohio in 1978-79, somewhere around there, and they were called summary jury trials. In fact, the Federal Judicial Center has put out a video series on alternative dispute resolution, and one of the films is on summary jury trial, and it is hosted by a man who has done more of them, or at least had at that time done more of them than anyone else, Federal District Judge Richard Enslin from the Western District of Michigan. And one of the things that troubles me about this bill in its current form, and that's why I'm opposed to it, is that it ignores the lessons of history. We have been almost 20 years of documentation of summary jury trials and their application and how to use them and how not to use them, and this bill just ignores all that and writes something up completely of whole cloth and says, here's the way to do it. And it doesn't answer any of the questions that Brad just raised, and it is unilateral in its approach and in its application, and it's just a bad idea. If you want to go forward with it, there are some ways that summary jury trials can be helpful to people who are in litigation. No question about it. It's a helpful negotiation tool to see how six people see your case. But that's all it is. One anecdote, in Texas for a mass tort claims litigation, there were so many people that they impaneled multiple summary jury trials. They had groups of six people, and they would hear 10 plaintiffs' cases at a time because all the underlying facts were the same. The only thing that would have been different was whether or not these 10 people were entitled to compensation. They stopped doing that after the first version, the first segment, because the summary jury trials returned very different. They all heard the same evidence. They all heard the same information, and they returned out of 10 cases, they returned a split verdict as to whether there was liability. Six said there was liability. Four said there wasn't. These things are not foolproof, and they're not meant to replace the other system. What they're meant to be is negotiation aids, and we ought to, if we're going to capture them in statute, we ought to look to the experience of other places and capture it to the way that best helps us.
Questions for the committee? I just have, I want to raise maybe just several issues with you and see if I'm reading this bill right. I don't see any requirement that the common sense jury has to go through a voir dire process. I don't see any anything here as whether this common sense jury has to come to a unanimous decision or majority. Am I reading that correctly? You have any comments on
Chair Ackerman, that is correct. The bill is silent on voir dire. It appears to say that you pick six persons at random from the jury pool, and they sit as the common sense jury. It's silent about a whole number of procedures, including the ones that you mentioned.
Well, let me ask this question. If I was summoned as a jury to a common sense jury, would I have to go? I mean, this isn't a real jury.
Mr. Chair, I think that would be different based on different districts as to how the court would apply those rules because, as you know, some of our court systems only ask people to show up for one trial. Mm-hmm. So it would raise an interesting question if you can show up for a summary jury trial or in this, as what they're calling it, a common sense jury. Another issue that raises a big concern in the federal system where this is applicable, where they do it, is do you tell the members of this jury panel that their verdict is merely advisory. In other words, it frankly doesn't count. One of the difficulties in those circumstances is people who deliberate differently if they think that the verdict I'm about to render matters, and if they think, or if they've been told in advance, that you're just offering an advisory opinion. That lets people off the hook considerably.
Then my last question, just based upon your trial experiences, assuming that these common sense juries would have an opening presentation by the attorneys or some evidence taking. You have to have some voir dire. You have instructions by the court to the jury so the juries can understand what its function is. Can you relate that to the two-hour time limit that's being imposed by the bill?
Sir, Chair Ackerman, it's not possible. In many, many instances, the two-hour time limit would be very short. There are services who act in Portland, a number of large cities, that offer these summary jury trials to people who are preparing their cases. And good trial attorneys on big cases use them because they give them a chance to vet their ideas and to go through what their evidence is and to find out how people respond. But they take more. 2 hours is not a very long time in a judicial proceeding.
Fine. Thank you. Further questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you. Mr. Johnston, with your experience from the historical perspective in regard to summary jury trials, how do other states handle calling in panelists for a summary jury trial? And do their states' rules of civil procedure preside?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I think it's a matter of local court procedure. I'm frankly not aware of other state court jurisdictions that have adopted summary jury trials as part of their system. The federal system is the only one I am aware of.
I see. Thank you.
All right. Committee, any further questions? Thank you for your testimony. You're excused. Anyone else wishing to testify on these three bills? Please come forward. Seeing none. Yes, Mr. Mannix. Right. Now, I'll have to give Mr. Lane an opportunity. We have a little bit of time left. Is Mr. Lane still in the building? Yes, here we are. Bottle. Okay.
Well, it's just, Mr. Chairman, Kevin Mannix, I appreciate the chance just to come up briefly. I think that one concept that could be applied to the settlement offer proposal is to put a cap on the exposure that you may have as to prevailing party fees and attorney fees. If there's a concern about someone being put in a position where they have to worry about going up against General Motors, and that if General Motors makes a settlement offer, that's a low-ball offer, one way to encourage the parties to look realistically at that is to put some exposure on the books. You could cap it at $5,000. You could cap it at $10,000. But it is possible to put some sort of limitation in there so that you're not creating an extraordinary situation. And even small businesses going up against big businesses would appreciate that. But the idea is to put some pressure. When there is a settlement offer on the table, to put some pressure on the plaintiff to be realistic about looking at the value of that offer. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lane, any response?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have no further comments on that block of bills.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much for your continued testimony. Any further witnesses on these three bills? If not, I'll close the public hearing on House Bills 2744, 3208, and 3212, and open the public hearing on House Bills 3209 and House Bill 2748. Counsel, will you explain the bills, please?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 3209 provides that a class action may be maintained only for members of a class who are residents of Oregon. It also provides that an order certifying a class or an order denying certification of a class is appealable, and it requires a stay proceeding in action until the final appellate judgment has been entered on appeal. House Bill 2748 is encompassed within House Bill 3209.
Thank you. Once again, I'll ask Mr. Mannix, Mr. Lane to come forward and within the appropriate time frames, give us your opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Kevin Mannix, attorney from Salem. Here is project manager for the Oregon Litigation Fairness Project. I should indicate, by the way, not all of these bills were filed at our request. Some of them were, some were not. We've certainly been speaking in favor of all the bills and will continue to do so, but I thought that clarification might be handy. Mm-hmm. I'd also reiterate that we did provide a packet of information that we'd asked be made part of the record on these two bills, which encompasses all of the concepts that are being discussed or heard by this committee yesterday and today. These two bills relating to class actions provide the legislature with an opportunity to establish one point of efficiency in the class actions that I think is very significant, and that has to do whether or not when there has either been a determination that a class action is appropriate or a determination that a class action is not appropriate, that is, the court refuses to authorize the case to proceed as a class action, that decision be appealable at that point. before the parties go to the expense of preparing the rest of the preparation of the case to proceed with the case or the defense of the case. It simply allows a direct appeal of that decision. And that decision, of course, can be the trigger for a tremendous series of additional events in litigation. If a class action is established and it's inappropriate and the defendant has to go to all the expense of defending that case and then later on appeal it's found out that that original decision was wrong, look at the expense that's been incurred. On the other hand, if the class action is not allowed early on, and the plaintiff proceeds, the plaintiff is faced with the situation of not having been able to draw in people who should have been drawn into the case. So in that one sense, I think that the legislature is provided with the opportunity to improve the efficiency and fairness of the judicial process as it relates to class actions. The second part of this of these bills that comes in front of you has to do with whether or not members of the class ought to be non-Oregonians. That is, 3209 and 2748. I want to double-check my talking points to make sure 2748 also contains that, and the short answer is it doesn't. The 3209 contains a provision that says a class action may be maintained only for those members of a class who are residents of the state. That provision that's in 3209, not a bill that was requested by the Oregon Litigation Fairness Project, raises some questions in my mind. And so I'm not going to present advocacy in favor of it.
Thank you. Mr. Lane?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Richard Lane. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association and here to oppose both 2748 and 3209. Before I begin, I'm going to warn the committee members that I don't practice regularly in the area of class actions. And there will be other people here prepared to testify to the bill that as far as technical application of class action rules, they are far better witnesses to ask questions of. But the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association has looked at both bills and opposes them because, in fact, they're going to cause greater inefficiency. You're going to have longer delays to resolution, and a greater cost is going to be imposed on both sides because of this possibility of a possible series of interlocutory appeals over what a judge considering class action status does. As Mr. Mannix has said, as far as the aspect of 3209, and the residency requirement, that certainly raises numerous red flags as far as constitutionality. It also practically raises questions about when you're going to say that it's a resident, what do you do with foreign corporations that actually have a presence in here that may have been harmed, when was the people harmed, when do they have to be, can they come to the state to take advantage of this? There's a lot of procedural problems as well as constitutional issues raised with 3209, and I believe Mr. Mannix has recognized those. So we encourage you to oppose both 2748 and 3209.
Fine. Thank you, gentlemen. Questions from the committee? Seeing none, then you're excused. I don't have anyone else signed up for either of these bills, although I do believe we have some written testimony from David Sugarman. Is that correct? Are you here?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't see you there. Come on up. I just read the note. I thought maybe someone was submitting testimony on your behalf, but I'm sure you're capable of doing a better job.
I don't know about that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is David Sugarman. I'm an attorney in Portland. I have a substantial experience in handling class action cases, and I'm speaking in opposition to HB 2748 and 3209. For purposes of identification, I should explain to you that I sit on the Council on Court Procedures. There was some discussion about the council earlier this morning. I'm not speaking on behalf of the council. I'm not authorized to do so, but I'll get back to why I mentioned that in just a moment. The council, so that you know, is a state agency that is charged with the responsibility of monitoring, revising, improving the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure. And contrary to what I think I heard from Mr. Mannix earlier this morning, the council takes its responsibilities very seriously in protecting the public interest. We meet in a basement in the bar on Saturday mornings. It's windowless, it's dark, it's cloudy, it's rainy, and it's not much fun. But our job is to look at the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure and think about what changes we'll do. And one of the things we spend a lot of time thinking about is unintended consequences. And part of what I want to talk to you about is unintended consequences this morning of these two bills, or the major part, which is granting any party who's unhappy with a class certification decision the absolute right to appeal. Okay? Now, let me first address existing Oregon law. Under existing Oregon law, when a class action is filed, any decision in the case can be subject to an appeal if the trial court certifies it for appeal and the Court of Appeals agrees to hear it. In other words, class actions are treated as a special type of case because they can be very complicated, they can be very expensive, very time-consuming, and the court wants to make sure, as one judge has said to me in the past, we would rather be right than fast. And so under the right circumstances, a trial judge will, in fact, certify a decision for appeal, including a decision certifying a class. Here's where I'm concerned about unintended consequences. As I understand the motivation, or at least part of what's going on for these bills, there's a concern generally about meritless cases, the watchword frivolous lawsuits we hear so much about. What this legislation will do is hand over the keys to the courthouse to somebody who may have filed a meritless case. How could that have happened? Well, if we pass these two bills, either of these two bills with this provision, let's assume, hypothetically, that somebody has filed a lawsuit, a class action lawsuit, against any business in the state, and let's assume further that that case has absolutely no merit whatsoever. Okay? The judge, on motion to certify the class action, takes evidence, considers the law, considers whether this case should go forward as a class action, and he or she properly says, I'm not certifying this as a class action. All right? What happens? Meritless case and its counsel has an immediate right of appeal, regardless of the merits. He or she appeals because, A, I can send this case into a long trip into the Court of Appeals. That's generally going to be about 2 years' worth of work. And B, I can hope that something will happen in the meantime. So what we have done is handed over the keys to this case to somebody who may or may not have the system's best interests at heart. And while businesses may assume, and corporate entities and good corporate citizens of our state may assume that they want this bill because they can appeal any decision immediately as a matter of right, in fact, I think this is a be careful what you wish for kind of bill. And I think the unintended consequences here are going to have a very serious impact on all sorts of corporate interests in this state. The other thing I want to point out is just on this other issue in 3209, which is excluding out-of-state residents from participation in class actions. This, again, is a great study in unintended consequences. Sometimes businesses file class actions or participate in class actions. And in my written materials, I've cited one to you. When, for example, an insurance company overcharges premiums, and the only cost-effective method of recovering those overcharges is through a class action method, if we were to pass, if the committee were to pass on and the legislature were to pass 3209, what we would be saying to Intel, Boeing, Hewlett-Packard, any other number of businesses that are not, as we generally define residents of the state, you can't participate in that case. You've got to bring your own case if you want to sue for premium refund. Now, maybe that's not such a big deal. The reality is, under existing Oregon law, a court absolutely may exclude residents, non-residents, from a state court class action based on the facts that exist and the claims that exist in that case. And I've cited those cases for you also in the written materials. Those are all my remarks, unless anybody on the committee has questions, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
Yes, thank you for being here this morning. Questions from Representative Garrard.
again, maybe simply a non-attorney question here. When a judge rules against certification of a class, does he issue a reason why he has denied the certification?
Mr. Chair and Representative Rudd, yes. In fact, a court is required to set forth with particularity under the rules why he or she has decided not to certify a class action.
Follow, Mr. Chair?
Yes, you may.
Could then this bill be amended to reflect that such a case was non-appealable?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ware, I have a hard time conceptualizing of legislation that the short answer is I suppose any bill can be amended. And I'm not sure I understand your question. If you're asking, are there, can we say there's a certain species of cases which would be accepted from automatic appeal? I suppose you could, but you would have to think very carefully about how you do that. Now, the other thing I should point out to you and to the committee, and I know this isn't necessarily going to make sense, and I may be overanalyzing this legally for you. Technically, a court does not consider the merits of the case in deciding whether to certify a class action or not, although under the Oregon rules, there are certain considerations that a court can enter into that may reflect on the merits. In other words, class certification is not supposed to be a determination on the merits. But a court has many, many ways, judges have a lot of tools in their toolboxes for deciding to certify a class or deciding not to. And a court under existing class action rules and the whole system that exists in class actions, it would take a major overhaul for an examination of the merits. I'm not sure I would think that's good policy choice for the simple reason that the class action decision is supposed to be made pretty early in the case, and the merits process usually takes longer to develop. I hope I haven't been too obtuse in answering your question.
Follow?
You may.
somewhat.
My apologies.
No. I'm a little confused now in okay. that you indicated earlier that, yes, there is an opinion, and I was addressing your concern about frivolous is where I was trying to go, that if a judge indicated that he felt this was frivolous, he could so indicate, thus denying any appeal because of the frivolous determination.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gerard, yes and no. There would ultimately be an appeal at the end of the case.
Not the answer I expected, yes or no.
From a lawyer?
From a lawyer, no. Yeah.
My apologies. What it would do is it would eliminate one appeal and collapse what would now be two appeals into one. Okay, you're still... If the court dismisses a case on any grounds, in theory, every party, every citizen in the state of Oregon has a right of appeal. Okay? Even if a case is dismissed as quote-unquote wholly without merit, right?
Okay.
So if the judge decides, if under the amendment I think you're thinking about, which is, okay, we just graft in a little provision that if the court concludes it's without merit, there's no automatic appeal. All right. What you're doing is you're eliminating the automatic appeal, but there's still the existing appeal as a matter of right. So it takes the two appeals and collapses them into one. That's the yes and the no.
Thank you.
With apologies.
I thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone want to try further questions?
I'm not going to ask any more questions.
Representative Flores?
I don't have a question, Mr. Chair. However, I would be interested in receiving a copy of the referenced written comments that we don't seem to have.
Okay. Did we distribute your comments?
Yes, I will.
Do you have them?
I do right here.
Okay, we'll get some assistance for you. Okay, since there's no further questions, Mr. Sugarman, you're likewise excused, and I appreciate your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
Are there, I have no one else signed up for these bills. Is there anyone else who would wish to testify? Yes, please come forward.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name for the record is Russ Walker, and I represent Freedom Works, Citizens for Sound Economy. I apologize for not signing up. I was out of the room when a sign-up occurred. I'll make it brief. We're supportive of 3209 and 2748. Our goal in supporting both these bills is to limit the number of what we consider frivolous suits. Don't provide any type of remedy to the class, but provide huge awards to the attorneys. And let me give you an example of that. I received this last week in the mail. In the last 2 weeks, we've received two of these at our house. One is from attorneys. It's the notice of your rights and an Allstate Fair Credit Reporting Act settlement. As a result of this class, which I apparently belong to, and so does my wife, we each receive one credit report. I can get that for free on the internet. I don't particularly need that. I don't need a bunch of attorneys to provide that for me, but I can get it for free on the internet. If you open this up, you'll see what the attorneys won. And I'd be happy to provide a copy of this to anybody. Attorneys get $8 million. That's what they got out of this. That's what we're trying to stop. This is precisely the kind of stuff that we find offensive and creates a huge burden on our economy. These types of lawsuits provide a drag on the economy in the form of what we've always called the litigation tax. I would consider this frivolous. Probably there's people in this room that would consider this the right thing, considering what the trial lawyers did in this case the right thing. The other one we got this week was for an award of 85% of the cost of a fee is paid to GMAC Mortgage. The attorney's got $160,000 per firm. I'm not sure what that fee, how much that fee is. I'm assuming it's probably about $300, maybe upwards of $1,000. We receive 85% of it. I didn't request to be a part of these classes. I think that's a big problem. I didn't feel harmed in either case. And I think most Americans that end up being part of a class are in the same condition. I understand why class actions exist. We don't want to eliminate the opportunity for classes to bring suit. We only want to provide what we consider some small remedy for many of the individuals out there that have class actions brought against them. We think both these bills do that. We think in the case of 3209 and in the case of 2748, both bills provide those companies and individuals that have classes brought against them an opportunity to appeal prior to investing enormous amounts of resources and dollars into one of these cases. Thank you. I'll take questions.
Fine. Thank you for your testimony. Questions from the committee? I just have a couple. You quoted awards and class attorney fee awards in class action cases. Is that how I understand it, Mr. Walker?
Yes, Mr. Chair, yes.
And in the case or cases that you cited, do you know how many claimants were in the class?
I haven't read through to find that information. No, sir.
It could be thousands, couldn't it?
It very well could be.
And in your familiarity with the class action process, do you know what the procedure is for the award of attorney's fees in a class action?
I do not.
Do you know that the plaintiff's lawyers would have to file appropriate documentation, and that could be contested by the defendants and the ultimate decision to the court? Are you aware of that?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right, then. Excuse me, Mr. Walker. Thank you for your testimony. Any further witnesses on these two bills? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2748 and 3209. We are a little bit ahead of ourselves today, which is always good news, and the next block of cases, I believe, were set to go into the afternoon session, but I'm going to start them now to exhaust all the witnesses that are here, and as we go into session, we'll see where we are. If we're not through, we'll certainly come back this afternoon and finish up the cases set for today. So, with that, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3076. 3210 and HJR 40. Counsel, would you explain these bills, please?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 3076 provides that punitive damages may not be awarded by, or may be awarded by court only if the award of punitive damages is expressly authorized by statute. It also imposes limits on awards of punitive damages, and it requires that a court impanel a new jury for purposes of considering the proper amount of punitive damages. It prohibits an amendment of a pleading to make a claim for punitive damages unless the party produces affidavits and supporting documentation that set out specific facts supported by the evidence that is both admissible and substantial, and it establishes that there is a probability that the plaintiff will prevail on the claim. It prohibits an award of punitive damages against a health practitioner unless the act or omission constitutes an intentional tort.
Thank you.
That was the first one. House Bill 3210 has some of the same provisions that the previous House Bill has, and it also provides that an employer or principal is not liable for punitive damages by reason of a tort of an employee or agent unless the employer or principal knew that the employee or agent intended to commit the tort and failed to take reasonable actions to prevent the commission of the tort, or the employer or principal ratified the actions of the employee or agent that constituted the tort. And finally, HJR 40 would propose an amendment to the Oregon Constitution that would impose limitations on the award of economic or non-economic damages in civil actions.
Thank you. Mr. Mannix, Mr. Lane, would you like to come forward, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Mannix, an attorney from Salem, and here is project manager for the Oregon Litigation Fairness Project. Again, in regard to these three bills, I'd ask the committee record reflect that we submitted a packet of materials which is available that discusses a variety of tort reform concepts and also discusses the concepts which underlie these bills. I'd like to speak briefly to HJR 40 first, because that's a straightforward question as to whether or not the Legislative Assembly wants to make a referral to the voters. The voters spoke recently in regard to the question of the award of caps, limitations on damages as to non-economic damages and what I'll generally call medical malpractice cases. The HJR 40 comes to you from a number of representatives and proposes a referral of an amendment to the Oregon Constitution to impose limitations on awards of non-economic damages in civil actions. I leave it up to the wisdom of the committee and the House as to whether or not the broader debate needs to be brought again to the voters of the state. I'd like to focus on the punitive damages bills, HB 3076 and HB 3210. As to those two bills, this provides the legislature with an opportunity to set some guidelines for punitive damages. Punitive damages used to be called exemplary damages. Well, we're going to make an example out of you. Now we call them punitive damages. We're going to punish you. They are separate from the recovery that a person makes for their economic loss. And that's always important. The Supreme Court of Oregon has recognized that you do not have a right, a constitutional right, to access to punitive damages. It's a question of public policy as to whether or not punitive damages ought to be imposed, because they're meant to punish or to make an example out of the defendant, separate from whatever economic recovery ought to be allowed to the plaintiff. So we do not have an access to the court's issue when it comes to punitive damages. The question is, who gets to set the policy as to punitive damages? Generally speaking, punitive damages have been addressed in two fashions. One is by specific legislation adopted by the legislature that says, if you do thus and so, or if you fail to do thus and so, you may be punished, a person may bring legal action against you and recover what their real economic damages may have been, but they also get these other damages as a matter of statutory right if they make their case. And there are a number of statutory provisions that address that. The other part is through the development of the common law. When the courts decide as a matter of public policy, discerning what seems to be appropriate, that this is a case where someone should be allowed to seek punitive damages. Generally, the courts have reserved that for cases where someone has engaged in highly inappropriate conduct that is conduct beyond the pale. There's case citations going back to the 1800s where the courts have described it, but basically it's egregious conduct and the court makes the determination it's appropriate to allow someone to seek punitive damages. Now, the United States Supreme Court has spoken of late on the issue of punitive damages by saying that at some point, punitive damages have to bear some proportion to the actual damages. If you're going to punish somebody through the civil process, there has to be proportionality. And the proportionality standard that we've generally heard from the United States Supreme Court is that it ought not to be more than 10 times. Double digits goes beyond or more than 9 times. If you start hitting double digits, you're in a danger zone as to disproportionality. That is, if it's, say, 20 times the actual economic damages, you're going to be in trouble, unless it's an extraordinary case. The guideline, and I'm speaking just generally here, is that if you go beyond single digits, watch out. These bills provide the legislature with an opportunity to have a discussion as to whether or not there ought to be some legislative guidelines on punitive damages. One opportunity is in 3076, which says that punitive damages are not allowed unless they are expressly authorized by statute. That is something the legislature could make a decision about. The legislature could say from now on, the only time you get to punish somebody beyond your actual economic damages is if the legislature has passed a law, which it has done in several circumstances, authorizing punitive damages. Frankly, I don't think that piece of that legislation has legs. I don't think the legislatures are anywhere near making that kind of jump, but the philosophical concept is in front of you. The more significant concept in 3076 and 3210 is establishing some legislative standards as to proportionality. And the standards which are made available in these bills vary, but they have to do with the nature of the claim and also the nature of the defendant or the size of the defendant's business. One of the most significant proposals here is to protect small business from being driven out of business by punitive damages. And that limitation, which is stated in these bills, in effect protects what you might want to define as small business. It opens the door to a description as to what may be considered an appropriate small business. The specific language from House Bill 3076 talks about punitive damages may not be awarded on the claim in an amount that exceeds 10% of the net worth of the business if the net worth of the business calculated as of the date the action is filed is less than $2 million. This kind of provision touches on due process, but also touches on the economic viability of the defendant. Remember, we're not talking about the actual economic recovery. We're talking about the punishment side. How far do you get to go to punish somebody? Taking 10% of their net worth away is a pretty heavy punishment. And I would argue that this is part of the most significant provision in these two bills that ought to be considered, which is to protect small businesses from being driven out of business. And why is that a concern? Because when you drive them out of business, think about the jobs that are eliminated. There are other people who are damaged as a result of exorbitant punitive damages against a small business. Now, the legislature may decide that 10% is not appropriate. Maybe it should be 5%. Maybe it should be 20%. But I do think this is an appropriate time, given the United States Supreme Court decisions, for the Legislative Assembly to take a look at the context of punitive damages and decide how far do you punish a small business. How far do you go, considering the impact that it may have on the jobs of others, and those other folks don't get to come in and make their case. Now, House Bill 3210 sets up some proportionality standards, and it also sets up some, in effect, some caps on non-economic damages that are proportionate to the actual economic damages award. I think the language of the bill is a little problematic because we've gone over it several times trying to understand the formula. The essential formula that does have to do with a ratio in different kinds of cases. It's different for personal injury and wrongful death as opposed to other cases. There's also a cap of as to economic damages exceeding $1 million. We think it says punitive damages may not exceed the economic damages. I do think the language of that bill would need to be clarified if this committee decides to go forward with it. The concept of proportionality is what is the essence of these two bills. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mannix. Mr. Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Richard Lane. I am here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and I am here to oppose both House Bill 3076 and 3210 and the referral HJR 40. Commenting just briefly on HJR 40, as Mr. Mannix recognizes, this has been an issue that has been presented to the people twice, once in a narrow focus, once in a wide focus. I don't believe that this is another matter that needs to be considered by the people. I think they have spoken loud and clear. On 3076 and 3210, these are wholesale revisions in the area of punitive damage law. Punitive damage law, as Mr. Mannix stated, is an exemplar damage awarded under existing law, ORS 31.730, when a party proves by clear and convincing evidence that a party has acted with malice or has shown a reckless and outrageous indifference or a conscious indifference to the health, safety, and welfare of another. That's the standard. In a regular civil case, a party prevails by a preponderance of the evidence. Criminal cases we have beyond a reasonable doubt. Clear and convincing is higher than a mere preponderance, lower than beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a heightened burden in order to recover that and limit it to those situations where there has been a reckless or outrageous indifference to the health, safety, and welfare of all Oregonians. In order to even bring a claim presently for punitive damages, there are pre-pleading requirements that need to be met. Again, under the existing punitive damage statute, you're required to actually move the court to allow a pleading to assert a claim of punitive damages. That requires presentation of evidence, and you're not permitted to plead it unless the court determines that you've presented enough evidence to survive what's called a directed verdict. That means the claim is going to the jury. It's been vetted in front of the judge. So you've got a heightened burden. That burden has been met. It's limited situations, and a judge has allowed it to go forward for the jury's consideration. There are also numerous post-verdict reviews required, as Mr. Mannix noted, most recently by the intervention of the United States Supreme Court, most recently in a case called State Farm versus Campbell, which was an insurance case that arose out of Utah, and the court took that case up and used it as sort of an examination of the post-verdict review that a defendant is entitled to receive. And it talked about a number of factors that need to be considered and noted that the single most important factor for the imposition of punitive damages is the reprehensibility of the defendant's conduct. Number one. There is discussion in ratios, but they elected not to set any mathematical formula. They have chosen numerous times not to go to a mathematical formula. Both 3076 and 3210 now trigger a mathematical formula that is going to, for the first time, limit any recovery to the defendant's wealth. Exactly the position that the Oregon Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, and our own procedures under existing law say you shouldn't consider the financial wealth because you're looking at the reprehensibility of the conduct. 3210 ties the amount of punitive damages to the economic recovery. Punitive damages are designed to make somebody stop what they're doing. For all Oregonians, stop that conduct. That is reprehensible. We shall not have it. We shall not allow it. And yet the bill ties it to economic recovery. So elderly, small children without an economic recovery are not entitled to any punitive damages under that proposal. A wage earner, somebody, you know, supporting a family, who's going to suffer an economic loss associated with any injury or death, would then be entitled to a larger or any amount of punitive damages. And yet the conduct remains the same for the defendant who has caused injury to the child, the elderly, or the worker. And that's wrong. It's also not one of the factors that ever has been the focus of a punitive damage award. It's the conduct of the defendant. Presently under Oregon law, 31750 requires that 60% of any punitive damage recovery is awarded to the state and goes directly to the Crime Victims Fund. 40% is the only amount that's recovered by the plaintiff in any case. And the idea behind that, when it was amended, I think it was originally proposed at 50-50, and I think it's gone up over the years, was that punitive damages, in essence, are designed to protect all of society. And the justification, 60% would go to the state and for disbursements through the Crime Victims Fund, was a meritorious use of punitive damages. 3076, again, ties the recovery to compensatory damages. You're now not only putting in what Mr. Manick refers to as a proportionality, but you're limiting the total recovery, and you're limiting that recovery based upon the damages that a jury finds on a particular plaintiff and their own economic worth. State Farm versus Campbell that I mentioned talked about a number of factors. Most of them are omitted from this bill, all subject to the court's post-verdict review. The limitation to an authorization by statute cannot possibly cover all of the situations that may arise where punitive damages would be appropriate. The Oregon statutes have restricted the recovery of punitive damages in certain situations, but it's never said these are the only cases where punitive damages are alive. In fact, given the broad statement that they are appropriate when a defendant shows a reckless and outrageous indifference or a conscious indifference to the health, safety, or welfare, that in itself limits the cases that this is going to apply to. 3076, again, getting back to the theme of cost and duplicative use of resources, you spend 6 weeks in a products case where the defendant knew that for 15 cents you'd stop exploding vehicles. The jury hears all that evidence and decides that there was conscious, reckless, indifference and harm has been suffered. The evidence has been presented to that jury. You're going to let that jury go. And then you're going to impanel a second jury under 3776 to decide what amount of punitive damages is appropriate. You're now asking the parties to represent their entire case because some of the evidence regarding the liability and the punitive conduct has already been heard by the first jury that made a finding that punitive damages were appropriate. Lastly, 3210 eliminates what's a concept called vicarious liability. It indicates that a principal or an employer is only going to be liable for punitive damages if they knew that an employee or an agent was engaging in this reckless, outrageous indifference. That's an elimination of a concept designed to ensure that there's oversight, particularly, and I say this not in a mean-spirited way, but corporate activities, when you look at the Oregon case law where punitive damages have been awarded, tends to be the types of situations. Corporations that are doing things that are harming or killing Oregonians. Corporations only act by employees. There's an instruction in Oregon law that an employee is acting on behalf of the employer. And this bill would allow a corporate entity, that nebulous creation, to just say, we didn't know. We didn't know this employee was doing this. We didn't know that test was not going. We didn't know that that fraud was being committed. We did not know these people were being harmed. And that's a wrong approach to deter conduct of a corporation to make sure that it behaves as we expect as good corporate citizens. Members of the committee, thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Questions from the committee?
Yes, Representative Garrard.
Here comes a non, again, another one. I'm trying again. Under this bill, I don't know whether Kevin would like to answer it, or first of all, could a parent and their child be interpreted under this as a principal and an agent?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrard, I'll answer it first. House Bill 3210, Section 2 is the section we're talking about. It says an employer or principal is not liable for punitive damages by reason of any tort committed by an employee or agent. I don't think that that language contemplated parent-child relationships. And usually family law provisions deal with the responsibility of parents for the inappropriate civil action of minors. And there are specific statutory provisions regarding parental responsibility for minors. I don't think that this piece addresses that.
Representative Garrard, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would agree with that. I don't believe that that concept is incorporated in Section 2.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Representative Thatcher.
Yes, thank you. This is for either one of you, and it's
not an attorney, so therefore I don't know the answer to this question as I ask it to you, but in your the Oregon Civil Procedure Act, is there any guide, or whatever it's called, is there any guidelines given as to what amounts of punitive damages you would be asking for in a particular case?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, Mr. Lane did read the standard for what I call admission, whether or not you can get into the punitive damages gallery, whether or not punitive damages may be awarded at all. There is that standard, and you do have to have egregious conduct to be able to seek punitive damages. I'm off the top of my head, I am not aware of any proportionality requirement that presently exists.
Representative Thatcher, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is there an amount that the jury is told the parties is seeking in a case? Yes, if that's the specific question. Until the court allows the amendment to assert a punitive damage claim, a party is not entitled to allege even that they're seeking punitive damages, and they certainly can't claim a certain amount. It's only after the court has sort of allowed that amendment would a claim for punitive damages be allowed to be made in a complaint, and an amount would be sought, and there's also certain discovery aspects that are permitted to take place at that time that would not have been permitted to take place before that. And the last thing I would say is that the instructions that are given to the jury are set out, I believe it's 30.905, but that may be incorrect, of numerous factors that the jury is supposed to consider when deciding on the amount that would be appropriate, of which financial condition, amount of harm, profits from the scheme of deception, perhaps, are all factors that the jury considers.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Yes, Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a question regarding the punitive aspect or punishment aspect of punitive damages. If say, a scenario, if punitive damages were awarded in a case against a party, a small corporation, say, that was found guilty or to have acted with every possible way, malice, recklessness, outrageous indifference, highly unreasonable risk of just the most egregious thing, and the punitive damages were tied to their economic damages. Now, how would that be a deterrent to a much larger corporation acting in the same way? Doesn't the smaller amount, because it's tied to the economic damages, doesn't the smaller amount then become ineffective in being a deterrent to the larger corporation acting in such a way?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, I'll take it first. That's a legitimate point of debate. For a very large business, if you're limiting the punitive damages in terms of proportionality to the actual economic damages for a very big company, you could make the argument that there's not enough pain that's being imposed for the egregious conduct. Therefore, the proportionality ratio should be higher, or there should be no limit, although under due process, constitutionally, there is going to be a proportionality argument based on standards that the U.S. Supreme Court has now applied. I'd say the other side of that argument is, well, then for the small company, there ought to be a limitation such as the 10% of net worth that's suggested here, because it will be painful to that small company, and that could be so painful as to cause economic damage to people that work for the company.
Thank you.
Any further comments?
Mr. Chairman, may I ask permission to comment on one other thing that I overlooked in my preliminary remarks?
You may.
Under House Bill 3076, there is another provision which has to do with a change in Section 4 to ORS 31.740. The essential change to that statute is to take out the phrase, or to change the phrase, without malice. That has to do with the whole issue of punitive damage awards to healthcare practitioners. There was a recent court decision which, interpreting the word malice, kind of reopened the door to punitive damages being applicable to healthcare practitioners. That section of the bill comes up with a specific different standard, which is understandable, we think more clearly understandable, that says if there's an intentional tort committed by a healthcare practitioner they could be subjected to punitive damages. But if it's not an intentional tort, then they cannot be subjected to punitive damages. Right now, the standard is whether they acted without malice, and that is a less defined, more difficult term. If the committee prefers to keep the current language, we'd encourage the committee to come up with a definition of what malice means for that particular statute. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lane, any closing remark on that?
Mr. Chairman, no, unless there's one more question.
Oh, sure, counsel.
I guess I just had a quick question, really for either of you, probably for Mr. Mannix, regarding the limits on the punitive damages. And you mentioned something about how the language is a bit confusing, specifically on 3076. The way I read it, and I just want to clarify if this is your intention or what you want to put the limits at. But I read the way I read the bills, there's a limit, no matter what type of case, at $1 million. Am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, counsel, yes. Actually, I wasn't confused about 3076. I was confused about 3210.
Okay, and I read that the same way as well, that it was basically setting out the same limits in different language, but that's the limit is a $1 million limit regardless of what type of suit or action or anything else. Is that correct?
That's my reading of it, yes.
Okay.
Anything else from the committee? Seeing none, gentlemen, thank you for your testimony. You'll be excused, and I'll call the last panel. Russ Walker.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize as we go through. I'm not sure that the panel, the witness list would be complete given the anticipated schedule. We have a witness scheduled on these punitive damage bills, but we were told to have him here at 3, so there may be one more witness on the punitive damage aspect.
Okay, then we'll have to reconvene at 3 for that witness, and I'll accommodate that.
We can do it at the opponents now because I think they're here.
Yeah, well, let's keep going. We're going to finish out this panel. Right. Okay, you're through. Thank you.
Thank you.
And,
thank you.
We'll pick up the last two, Bruce Miller and Russ Walker. I know we're conscious of the time, but we're going to have to break in about 15 minutes, and it looks like we have a witness coming back at 3, so we'll reconvene then. Obviously, if you can get your testimony done before 15 minutes, you don't have to come back. That may be some incentive. Okay. Whoever wishes to go first.
Go ahead. Good morning, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller from the Office of the State Court Administrator. If I could, I'd like to take a moment to talk about House Bill 3076. We're not taking a position on this bill, but it did raise a couple questions for us that we would hope you would consider if you decide to move this bill to perhaps offer some clarification so that the courts will know how to proceed with this. The particular section that we're concerned with is Section 2 that establishes the second jury, and it raises a number of questions for us, such as what will they hear? How far back into the evidence does that portion of the trial need to go? How will they hear the evidence? Will it be presented by the attorneys again, or will it be presented in some other manner, perhaps recorded or some other fashion? What limits will there be, if any, on how the evidence will be presented? And the reason I raise that issue is it's very unlikely that someone would come in and try the same issues the same way two times in a row. Just because of human nature, it's difficult to present the same thing the exact same way twice. So there are questions about how the jury will hear and what they will hear. And those are the areas we would like to see clarification in if the bill goes forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Walker?
Yes, for the record, my name is Russ Walker, and again, I represent Freedom Works, Citizens for Sound Economy, and for those unfamiliar with the organization, just to recap, we're led by former Majority Leader Dick Armey and former White House Counsel C. Boyden Gray and former Vice Presidential Candidate Jack Kemp. Our organization fights for free markets, and we have about 30,000 members in the state of Oregon. So that's who I actually represent. Real quickly, we're supportive of both of these bills, 3076 and 3210, as well as HJR 40, recognizing that we've dealt with limits to or caps on non-economic damages. I'll focus my attention. We've had two election cycles on that. We're supportive of the referral, but rather than spend time on that, I'll talk about the other two bills real quick. Our big concern with punitive damages are the impact they have on, once again, the economy. Very specifically, we think they hurt small businesses the most. Of the $129 billion a year that's delivered out in tort awards, 94% of those awards are delivered by small and very small businesses. Let me define what I mean by that. Small businesses are businesses with less than $10 million a year in revenue, and very small businesses are businesses of less than $1 million a year in revenue. Small businesses, on an average, pay out $150,000 a year in litigation costs. Our concern with this is that when it comes to punitive damages, it's meant to punish the offender. We think, unfortunately, what ends up happening in many cases, especially when you're talking about small and very small businesses, is the punishment is usually, even though it goes to the offender, the business, or the individual, they usually have to absorb those costs, and they do it by either laying off employees or closing down their businesses. And unfortunately, to the guy making $7 an hour or $9, $10 an hour, he's the guy that actually has to live with that. He has to live with that punishment and find a new job. We really need to look at this in a broader context. When we punish small and very small businesses, it has a direct impact on the average individual on the street, and in many cases, whether or not the company they work for survives. Our intent is to limit the effect that punitive damages have on these small and very small businesses. It would be nice if we could have an exemption for just them. We agree that some of the language in 3210 is a little difficult to understand and probably needs to be reworked. But in general, we support the idea of limiting punitive damages. We would not be the first state to do it. Mississippi has done it, as well as four other states. We're not breaking new ground on this. It's been done in other places in different ways, and we can explore some of those ways. The committee can explore some of those ways in which it can be done to protect small businesses and very small businesses from the impact of heavy punitive damages. Thank you, and I'll take any questions you have.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. When you said small business had to pay $150,000 in litigation costs, did you mean liability costs?
I'm sorry. I meant liability. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Representative, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions for the committee? Hearing none, gentlemen, thank you for your testimony, and I'll excuse you at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further witnesses wishing to testify on these measures at this time? Let me inquire about the witness that will be in this afternoon. Is it confirmed that that witness will be here at 3 or 3:30, or do we know? I want to adjourn to that time. 3 is okay? 3.
Mr. Chairman, 3 o'clock. He's probably going to be here in about 45 minutes to an hour for lunch, so I know he's going to be in solution whenever the committee
can. Okay. Then what I'll do, hearing no further business coming before the committee at this time, we will adjourn until 3 o'clock this afternoon. Hi. The civil subcommittee is back in session, and what we're going to do is close out with our block three of bills, House Bill 3076, House Bill 3210, and House Joint Resolution 40, and then I will close the public hearings on that one, on those three, and open it up on any other, to accommodate any other witnesses that were not here this morning. I have your lists. So for the bills that are still open, I'd like to hear from Daryl Fuller and Connie Gallagher. And we'll take them first, and then I have behind them Mark Jackson and Pete Shepard. So let's come up by twos.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Daryl Fuller. I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, and I'm here today also on behalf of the Oregon Small Business Coalition. My goal is simply to make Pete Shepard work harder, and so I'm glad to see that he's here this morning, this afternoon. My testimony on House Bills 3210 and 3076 will be substantially similar to my testimony on the previous bills that you've heard, and that is on behalf of retail businesses that face lawsuits on a regular basis, often lawsuits that we believe do not have merit. We are in a position of making a decision of paying a lot of money to prove that we're right or settling a case out of court simply because it's less expensive to make the problem go away, even when we haven't done anything wrong, than it is to litigate to prove we're right. Certainly one of the things that weighs heavily on the minds of any business person who's facing a potential lawsuit is that if they don't prevail, that they have absolutely no idea what they're going to face at the other end of the tunnel, because there are no limits on what can be awarded to the defendant in terms of punitive damages. There just is, it's wide open, and it scares businesses, and it puts a, for lack of a better term, a chilling effect on a businessman saying, I would much rather settle, or the insurance company pressures the business person to settle the case, because the insurance company potentially would pay some of the loss, and they would much rather have the case settled out of court for a small amount of money than to be vindicated and going through the court system. So bills such as these or the others that the committee has heard of the last couple of days that would have an impact on the atmosphere of litigation in Oregon, I think would be a positive step in moving the pendulum closer to the middle, where we believe that the plaintiff's rights and opportunities in the state of Oregon are out of balance with those of the defendants. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
All right, before we proceed with questions, I just want to make one short announcement. We have had distributed a memorandum from the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association dated today regarding House Bill 3076 and 3210. You should have that for your files. You should also have copies of Ms. Gallagher's testimony, and we'll call upon her to proceed at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Connie Gallagher. I'm the Administrator of Crime Victims Assistance Section at the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in opposition to House Bills 3210 and 3076 based upon the significant fiscal impact of these bills. I would also like to mention that Mr. Steve Dole from Crime Victims United wanted to be here but is unable to be present for this hearing, and he also opposes these bills. While Attorney General Myers opposes the general principle that is prescribed by the bills, I've been asked by the Attorney General to alert you to what is a very significant fiscal impact of these bills. So my remarks this afternoon will be limited to this concern. As you know, the criminal injuries compensation account is currently by statute the recipient of 60% of each of the punitive damage awards. These funds have provided over the past three biennia roughly 60% of the Crime Victims Assistance Section's other fund revenue. This represents approximately $24 million. As provided for in Chapter 147, these funds are used to support the Crime Victims Compensation Program and other victim services, such as our automated victim notification system and capital improvements for domestic violence shelters. Crime Victims Compensation provides for reimbursement to individual victims for their out-of-pocket crime-related costs. This program would stand to lose approximately 40 to 60% of its funding if limitation is placed on punitive damages. The state would also stand to lose federal funds, which are provided at a 60% match to state expenditures. As stated, the Attorney General opposes the shift in policy presented in these bills. If the policy should nonetheless seem attractive, the enormous fiscal impact on victim services must be considered. If the fiscal limitations are put into place, other sources of revenue will be needed if Oregon is to maintain viable services for crime victims. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Questions from the committee? Yes, Representative McPherson.
Ms. Gallagher, could you just give me a kind of a refresher on what happens to punitive damages, how they're allocated under current law?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, there's no complicated formula to how they're allocated once they come to victim services.
I mean, a certain amount goes to the plaintiff in the action, and other amounts go to victim's assistance, and I thought maybe there was some other public source that they go to, but I'm unclear. I just need to be refreshed on that.
Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, I can read you directly from the statute if you'd like, but basically 60% of it comes to the criminal injuries compensation account. 40% shall be paid to the prevailing party. The attorney for the prevailing party shall be paid out of the amount allocated under this paragraph and the amount agreed upon between the attorney and the prevailing party.
Okay. That's what I needed. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, then, thank you for your testimony. And we'll bring up the next panel that I called earlier, Mark Jackson and Pete Shepard, and this is on House Joint Resolution 40. Am I getting one victim?
Good afternoon,
okay,
Mr. Chair. My name is Pete Shepard. My job is to follow Darrell Fuller around and correct the errors in public policy that he induces, so I'm pleased to be here this afternoon. I'm here on behalf of Attorney General Hardy Myers, who is appearing today and presiding over a meeting of the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force in Eugene, else he would have been here in person. He asked me to extend his apologies to the committee. The Attorney General is opposed to HJR 40. Article 1, Section 17 of our Constitution states, in all civil cases, the right of trial by jury shall remain inviolate. Constitution state rules of law. Applying Article 1, Section 17 as a rule of law, the Oregon Supreme Court, in a case called Lakin, struck down previous statutory attempts to limit the right to trial by jury by imposing a statutory cap on what are known as non-economic damages. That's why, of course, HJR 40, which would reimpose a cap, does so in the form of a proposed constitutional amendment rather than a statute. But in addition to stating rules of law, constitutions also express and state fundamental values. Article 1, Section 17 uses the sweeping term all and the enduring term inviolate. The framers thus expressed their trust in the capacity not only of their living peers to decide any civil matter, but also their belief that future generations of jurors would be no less capable than the ones that they knew in 1857. Now, the values expressed in Article 1, Section 17 were so universal in 1857, there apparently was no debate about the terms of that provision of our Constitution. And indeed, since Lakin was decided, there has been a discovery of original records of the Oregon Constitutional Convention, which previously were unknown to Oregon's courts and unavailable to historians. And they confirm that there was not even any debate about the terms of that provision of Oregon's Constitution. So uncontroversial was the proposition that jurors can be entrusted with all civil matters and that right should be preserved inviolate. HJR 40 expresses a very different judgment about jurors. It expresses the view that our fellow citizens sitting as jurors in judgment upon our disputes cannot be trusted to limit non-economic damages to amounts reasonably calibrated to the circumstances of a particular dispute. Simply put, the Attorney General agrees with the values expressed originally by the framers of our Constitution and disagrees with the distrust of jurors that is necessarily embedded in HJR 40.
Excuse me, I was reading a note, and is humorous only to me because I made a mistake in announcing someone's name, and I'll have to reinvent the wheel here in a minute.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't troubled. I assumed you were reviewing your notes of Mr. Fuller's testimony on the earlier bill.
Mr. Shepard drive a new car, does he?
Mr. Chair, I recently did purchase a new car, though I fear to say that I bought it from a Washington dealer. So,
all right, are you ready for questions? Committee, any questions of Mr. Shepard? Seeing none, thank you very much. The next witness is actually Mark Younger. I called him Mark Jackson because he's Mark Younger from Jackson County. Okay, please come forward. I'm sorry I got your name confused with your location.
Not a problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name's Mark Unger. I'm here in opposition to HJR 40. My mother, in March of 2002, informed me that she had cancer, Burkitt's lymphoma. At a birthday dinner, my first knee-jerk response was to ask a lot of questions, get upset. She told me not to worry about anything. She'd seen the doctors. She felt totally safe with what was going on. She'd worked in the facility that treated her for 18 years, had lots of friends, felt very safe, guess you could say in the best of hands. We were wrong. My mom was killed by two totally preventable medical errors. One being the doctor did not follow protocol in the administration of methotrexate, which is nuclear medicine for the treatment of cancer. He neglected to test my mom at 24 hours, at 48 hours as required. When he did test at 72 hours, he misread the level of medication, and it come from the lab in nanomoles, in micromoles, and he thought it was nanomoles, which is a factor of 1,000. The bummer with methotrexate is that it's about the worst nuclear medicine there is. My mom was burnt from the inside out, took her 12 days to die. Once they realized that she was, they said she had bed sores. These bed sores were on the insides of her arms, on her chest, on her breasts, on the top of her thighs, not the part of her body that was on the bed. They realized that she was burning from the inside out, so they decided to transfer her to a burn center in Emmanuel in Portland. Well, we had no family there, so we requested they send her to Harborview in Seattle because that's where my aunt lives, and figuring we had a long recovery process, not knowing what was going on, it would just facilitate the family rehabilitating her and getting her better. Once we got her to Harborview, they realized that this methotrexate had totally eliminated her white blood cells. She had no immune defense system whatsoever. That the burn center couldn't have her, so they transferred her to the University of Washington, which has a bone marrow ward, and they could put her in a positive pressure unit. Once we got up there, finally drove up, caught up to her, they'd ran some tests and found out that the methotrexate levels at that time were still severely toxic. There was nothing they could do. We were trying to figure out what to do. Kept checking the white blood cell counts, seeing if they had come up. Nothing was happening. I was sitting in the room at one point with my mom holding her hand, trying to figure out what to do. My options were to go to the doctors, tell them to pull the plug. The nurses had come in. We're going to clean the bedding again. Her fluids were flowing out of her body, four IV pumps, thousands and thousands of cc's going into her as fast as they could. It was just burning, coming out of her body, faster than they could get it in her. When I had to leave, I was holding her hand. When I picked her hand up, took it off, all of the skin out of the palm of her hand was in my hand. I knew at that point that it was over with. Wasn't anything we could do. I had to end it. So I called the family together, went into a room, and we made the decision. It eased all of us, including the staff in Seattle, because we could end the pain and suffering. They said she was on enough morphine to kill a horse. They'd pull the respirator out of her, and she quit breathing instantly. Her diaphragm had collapsed, her nervous system had failed, and she'd just go away like that. 16 hours later, my mom died. She didn't go away. She breathed on her own. They took pain meds away from her as much as they could without her feeling pain. The only way that we were able to end it was to reduce the IV fluids and let her dehydrate to death. This happened in 16 hours from being totally hydrated to being dehydrated and dying. She died with the respiration 12 a minute, probably. It went away pretty quickly. Blood pressure 28/16. Nobody even comes close to living at that. The medical system needs to be held accountable. Weakening the justice system does nothing to improve medical safety. We have to hold them accountable for their negligence, and especially in preventable medical errors. That's what the democracy of the United States is about. That's why we have a jury of our peers to make those decisions for us, not insurance companies. You know, us as people, this is about people. It's a nonpartisan issue. I'm Republican. I am so opposed to this because it's a direct effect upon me. We trusted the system. My mom worked there for 18 years. My aunt worked there for 20 years. I worked there myself for 3 years. But we felt like she was going to be treated like the president. And it failed us miserably. And it could have been caught. It could have been prevented at 3 different occasions. And if they had the safety systems in place at the hospital, they could have caught his mistake. And this would have never happened. It's just unfortunate, and this can't pass. We, the voters, in 2000 and 2004 have said no to this. I don't think we need to say no again. I think we've got our point across. Thank you. Any questions?
Yes. Any questions of the witness? Hearing none, I thank you for your testimony again. Any other witnesses on the three bills we're considering, or the two bills on the House Joint Resolution 40? Mr. Mannix, you've already testified, haven't you?
Yes, I request an opportunity to discuss one issue, a new issue.
All right, I have to give Mr. Lane, if he's... See, I can't see that far back. He's here. Yeah, you can both come forward. He gets to rebut your new issue.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me an opportunity to come forward for a moment. You heard testimony from the Department of Justice in regard to the Crime Victims Fund, and new testimony, first time I've heard it, that they're concerned about the fiscal impact of any limitation on punitive damages on the Crime Victims Fund. First, I'd like to make it clear that I don't think there's anybody in this state who is more supportive of crime victims than I am. I've been an advocate for crime victims from the day I got into public life, and I will maintain that position. I've been very concerned throughout the development of this legislation about the potential impact on crime victims' assistance, because punitive damages that are awarded, 60%, do go towards crime victims' assistance. But I would ask that any particular cap that is discussed, if it's being discussed, be subject to analysis by the Department of Justice before they come in with a fiscal impact statement. The statement that I heard and read today is conclusory. And yes, it's important to go back and analyze any of these bills. For instance, the small business cap that's discussed, it says no more than 10% of the net worth of a small business valued at less than $2 million should go to punitive damages. It would be helpful to know from the Justice Department if any time in the last, say, 4 to 6 years, that cap would have applied in any given case and what the cost would have been. So what I'm simply saying here is we would certainly like to see the details of any kind of fiscal impact rather than the conclusory statement, because if there is a substantial fiscal impact on the victims' assistance funds, I'd be the first to be very concerned about that, and I do want to see that information. Thank you.
Mr. Lane, any response?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you.
Fine. Thank you again for your testimony and your participation. Any further witnesses on the House Bill 3076, 3210, or House Joint Resolution 40? Seeing none, then I will close the public hearing on those three measures. And this is our next step.
Yeah.
I will reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3209 and call as the sole witness that signed up for that bill, Earl Campbell. Please come forward. Good afternoon.
For the record, my name is Merle Campbell and I live in Boring, Oregon. Actually, the new town of Damascus in that city limits. Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm testifying both on 3209 and also a similar measure, 2748. They're nearly identical, except that 3209 has a provision in it that says that all members of a class in Oregon will have to be residents of Oregon. First, my opposition is to the what I call a perpetual motion scheme of the appeals process called for in both of these bills regarding certification of the class. Before anything goes to the court, the defendant has an opportunity to file appeals, and that stops the litigation until that appeal is heard. And the way I look at this, there's appeal after appeal after appeal, that this can continue for a long time. And it's somebody with poor health, somebody that has limited resources, this escalates the cost. Some people could die before they get to this point. And I have experiences in a class action, contrary to the way a lot of businessmen would like to have you think. Class actions are not a walk in the park. It takes an awful lot of effort on the consumer and an attorney's part. You can't just walk into an attorney's office and get them to represent you, even though you have substantial claims of injury or fraud. It doesn't happen. I was involved in a class action against General Motors over the diesel engines. I went through 12 law firms before anybody would listen because of the intimidation factor. They have millions of dollars. We will not be able to bring this to court. We got law firm and we prevailed. But it took 12 attorneys, 12 different law firms. Right now, my daughter is in another state. She has toxic mold in her house. She had a good attorney. He went in for a hemorrhoid operation and died. Now she can't find another attorney. Nobody's willing to take on the largest builder in the United States. This thing is not a balance of justice. This is taking a limited legal action and taking it out of the grasp of the consumer. It takes an inordinate amount of time. I spent 2 years working on the class action. I didn't do anything else working with my attorney before we prevailed. I'm a diabetic and I'm having some difficulty here, so bear with me. On the other side, we're about the state line within the state. Communities aren't always just divided by a state line. There's people who live on both sides of a state line or of a river or whatever, and they're part of that community. That means that somebody on one side of the river or the other side of the river or the state line that has an action against a manufacturer, be it medical or whatever, doesn't mean that it should be a separate class. What it means is that we have people of similar circumstances in communities that are arbitrarily divided by a state line, for instance. And then to cause them to have to go to court in two different circumstances rather than one is a waste of their money and a waste of time. Now, I realize that the manufacturers and the consumers, thank you, are viewed by some of the manufacturers or businesses as some kinds of prize, when in fact they're not. Most of the cases I have seen are not frivolous. They have a good basis to bring the court this thing to court. And most of the time when you try to certify the class, there's already a litmus test that they go through. I don't think the judges certify classes willy-nilly. I think they take a good, thoughtful length of time and process to go through this, and we're trying to take that away. So I object on both of these measures for those reasons.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions from the committee to the witness? Okay, seeing none, thank you again. You're excused for this afternoon.
All right,
thank you for coming back. Any further testimony on House Bill 3209? Seeing none, then I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3209. Any further business to come before the committee this afternoon? Seeing none, we're adjourned.